Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning and welcome to an exciting episode of Atlanta Legal Experts Radio Show. My name is Emily Rowell and I'm with Peachtree Offices. Today we got a newbie working as producer engineer in the room. Good morning. It's Ryan McPherson.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And as always, we have Rich Casanova with us. He's my co-host today. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I just never leave the building. I'm always here.
I know. Kind of stalky.
A little bit, yeah. But excited. A great show this morning. It's going to be fun to be your co-host this morning.
Yeah, I'm excited. This episode of Atlanta Legal Experts has been brought to you in part by Peachtree Offices and 3A Law Practice Management. You can find their logos and links to their website on atlantalegalexperts.com. Today, we have a wonderful expert list here. I'm going to introduce you to Matthew Rosenkopf of Taylor English Duma, LLP. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Loretta Lepore with Media Bar. Good morning.
Good morning.
And C.R. Wright, partner in the Atlanta office of Fisher & Phillips, LLP.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you so much for being here. We will go ahead and start off with Matthew Rosenkopf. You're on the spot. You ready?
Absolutely.
Matthew Rosenkopf is a member of Taylor English's Litigation and Dispute Resolution, Employment, Labor and Immigration, and Data Security and Privacy Practice Groups. Mr. Rosenkopf's practice extends to all phases of commercial litigation. Specifically, Mr. Rosenkopf's experience includes representing individuals, companies, and condominium/homeowners associations in litigation matters concerning, for example, contractual disputes, business torts, labor and employment issues, real estate disputes, and resort and hospitality disputes. Mr. Rosenkopf also represents those who are the subject of complaints and claims under various consumer protection statutes, including, but not limited to, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, Telephone Consumer Protection Act, Georgia Fair Business Practices Act, and Florida Consumer Collection Practices Act. Mr. Rosenkopf is licensed to practice law in Georgia as well in Florida. Mr. Rosenkopf has experience practicing in federal courts in both Georgia and Florida, before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, in appellate courts, and in American Arbitration Association proceedings. He has been selected as Georgia Super Lawyer's Rising Star for 2012, 13, and 14. Mr. Rosenkopf has also served as a director on the Board of Directors for the North Fulton Bar Association since 2012. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Can I hire you to say that and follow me around? That
was amazing. I was stumbling a little bit there.
Not at all. Thank you for that introduction.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this. Tell me about defense litigation a little bit. Let's explain to our listeners what that is and the rising costs of that.
Sure. That's actually an extremely hot button issue right now. When you say defense litigation, it's a broad term and it'll cover all different areas of practice. You're basically talking where companies and individuals are suing each other. More often than not, based on just experience, ending up on the defense side. So we represent companies and individuals that unfortunately end up on the wrong end of a business dispute where somebody is suing them or where they have a claim asserted against them. I also do represent folks on the plaintiff side, but when I talk about plaintiff side work, we're not talking about contingency type personal injury cases, mostly where you have a business suing another business or a business person suing another business person under a contractual fraud or various types of theories. But then you also raised a really interesting question that kind of piggybacks on top of that, which are the rising costs of litigation. Unfortunately, the way our court system is, it's a pay-to-play system. If somebody files a claim against you, unfortunately, it gets pretty costly. And there's only so much you can do to manage the costs in a particular case. And it becomes very frustrating sometimes when you're on the defense side to have to explain to a client that you can only control so much. Sometimes if you have an attorney on the other side or a client on the other side that wants to take certain approaches, conduct discovery in certain ways, there's really not much you can do from a cost standpoint. You can try to minimize those costs. You can be as efficient as possible. But if they are intent on taking 10 depositions in a case or propounding the full maximum number of interrogatories and hundreds of requests for production of documents, there's only so much you can do.
Can you tell me what Taylor English's model is according to what, you know, the rising costs?
Absolutely. Taylor English is different law firm than any that I've been at. I started at a big 100-plus lawyer firm in Miami, then moved over to a mid-sized firm of about 40 to 50 lawyers at one point. Taylor English, we're over 100 lawyers now, but it's different than your traditional big law firm model. It's focused on driving value to your clients, or results-oriented, not focused on being a bottom line to a business and trying to partner more with our clients. Looking at the relationship between the attorney and client as not just being your lawyer, not just being a bill that they have to pay at the end of the month, but trying to see how you can best drive value and not so much worry about lining our own pockets, but trying to help the client. So that way, you see a lot more repeat clients coming back and people that aren't, you know, just ticked off at having a huge legal bill from being involved in a heavy piece of litigation, but wanting to come back time and time again.
Right. That's awesome. Tell me, you mentioned you were in Miami as well. Are you basically able to practice in other states as well?
Yes, ma'am. I began my career as a Florida lawyer and then lateraled back here to Georgia after having lived here previously. And so I am both licensed in Florida and Georgia. One of the benefits to the age that we live in now is you can do a lot of things remotely through technology. Florida has just recently moved to a statewide e-file system throughout all their state courts. You don't have to physically have an office there to practice, so I'm able to practice just as the same as I'm here in Georgia. The only difficulty comes when if you have to travel for a deposition or a hearing, but that is a lot few and far between, and so not as often. And you know, you just work with the clients in those kind of situations.
Make it a weekend trip. Go to the beach. That's what I see.
We'd try, but unfortunately, it doesn't quite work that way. And, and the amount of times, I tell a story, I actually went to this was a number of years ago. I was in Florida, and I was reading and working and revising an appellate brief while sitting in a football stadium waiting for the Michigan University of Florida bowl game on January 1st.
Oh,
so
wow.
Not every trip to Florida is a picnic.
Right, right. And now let me ask you this. You also have a different type of clients, debt collectors. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. For about the past almost 8 years now, I have developed this niche practice representing companies and individuals that are in the debt collection world. And these are individuals that will be those folks out there sometimes making the calls, making those robocalls, trying to collect on debts. It's not always the most glamorous side of things when you talk to folks, because most people, when you hear about debt collectors, they have this image in their mind of people that are out there busting down doors, breaking kneecaps. But that is just not the case. Those are not the types of clients that I represent. The clients I represent are the ones that I think are getting an unfair shake based on the way that the law is being handled. It was a law created to help curb against abusive debt collection practices, but what has happened is it is a hyper-technical set of laws that, unfortunately, you'll have lawyers out there that will sue defendants on hyper-technical violations or on gray areas. And because of the rising cost of litigation, companies are faced with having to sometimes pay settlements where they otherwise don't think they did anything wrong. Unfortunately, I represent a lot of those clients that are doing things the right way. Sometimes mistakes happen. Sometimes they have a different viewpoint on whether something is legal or not, and we take the position that what they've done is correct. But sometimes you have to just fight about it in court.
Sure.
Matthew, Rich Casanova here, just checking in, listening to the show. So you're not the guy that called me then or whatever. Yeah, it's another guy that called me.
That is not me. And I'm not the one making the calls.
The one. I still have one good knee left. He took out the other one, but the other one's still good. So Emily was talking about these, collecting lawsuits and the debt collectors. So what difficulties or challenge do you have in representing those defendants, you know?
One of the biggest difficulties is the mounting costs of defense costs. You know, if you get sued, for example, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, there's an attorney's fees provision in the statute. So for a automatic violation, if somebody is found to commit a technical violation of the statute, there's an automatic attorney's fees provision. And courts have awarded attorney's fees ranging from the gamut of for all the reasonable attorney's fees and costs associated from taking the case all the way to the end, to sometimes minimizing it if the court does not think that it measures properly to the award that the client actually receives. So the attorney's fees on the plaintiff side, because you have to then explain to your client, if we're wrong, you could end up paying the attorney's fees on the other side. And that is a huge fear. And especially if you are faced with what could be a hyper-technical statutory violation, that is concerning, even if the most that the plaintiff could get is $1,000, you could be faced with a large multiplier of that. And that's on the Fair Debt Collection Practices side. I also do some Telephone Consumer Protection Act work. And that speaks to a different statute where that goes to robocalls using artificial automatic dialers. Now, while there's no attorney's fees provision in that statute, it's an automatic $500 per call. So if you have someone that maybe makes a mistake, $500 per call, you're not seeing a lot of individual lawsuits. You're seeing the rise of class action lawsuits, because then an attorney can certify a class and get hundreds of thousands of dollars just based on one person's mistake.
Are you talking about the like do not call list then? There's issues with that, right, if they violate that?
There are issues with the do not call list. What I was talking about was slightly different than the do not call. The do not call registry is a little bit of a different issue. This is just if you call somebody and you don't have
all your ducks in the row,
all your ducks in a row,
playing by the rules,
And I'll give you an example. I just wrote an article about one particular case that started down in this federal court here in the 11th Circuit, but it was started in the Southern District of Florida, where under the TCPA, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, you need prior express consent before you can use an auto dialer to call someone's cell phone. So, for example, if you have a cell phone and you get an auto dialed call from a debt collector or someone, some other marketer, and you had not given them prior authorized consent, that could be a violation. So what had happened in this particular case is an individual had put their cell phone number on a hospital record when they were going in to get some treatment. I think it was for a family member or so. The court took the position that that was not prior consent to call the cell phone. The FCC, the Federal Communications Department, has taken the view that that was prior consent. The judge disagreed. So while that might not seem like a big issue and it might seem kind of nerdy, there was a class action that was brought, and if they were wrong, that's $500 per call, not just for them, but for everyone that that particular
that
client,
or that client
was calling on medical debt, because they don't just get one particular person. They get maybe a whole batch of patients that may not have paid their bills.
Yeah, the snowball effect on that is huge, whatever, But it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? Because it's if people owe the money, the debt collector should have the right to contact them, you know, and they can't just say, well, I owe all these people money, but I'm going to put my phone number on do not call list and you can't call me on my cell phone. You can't call me to collect the money that's due, you know? So, I mean, it's kind of a touchy, it depends on what side of the fence you're sitting on, I guess, or table.
Absolutely. And even on the even on the defense side, though, I still take the position. You're absolutely right. I mean, those laws were created to make sure that people do things ethically and they're making calls in a way that aren't abusive.
Right,
and as long as they're not being abusive,
if they don't cross that line, that's where you come in,
Exactly. You know, in a lot of these types of situations, you have that exact circumstance where someone thinks a collector is being abusive.
Yeah.
That's why you try to counsel your clients to make sure you keep recorded calls, because where one person might think is abusive, if you have a recording of it, sometimes their story changes a little bit.
Right, right.
Sometimes it goes just the opposite. Sometimes somebody maybe says something that they didn't intend to say or meant for it to come across in a particular
otherwise
way.
Otherwise, it's just he said, she said, whatever. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So we understand you work with the North Fulton Bar Association. What's what is that? What's your capacity or what's your day in life there?
The North Fulton Bar Association is a very special bar association to me. It is focused, though not exclusive, but focused on lawyers who work and practice and have an interest in the North Fulton area, kind of north of the Chattahoochee is kind of a rough geographical estimate, though we don't expel members if they move south like I have. But it's a smaller bar association of in the low hundreds, about 130. 130, 140 members. Right. We have meetings about once a month. Very proud of our membership. We have a lot of judges and members of the judiciary that come around. We get guest speakers that come in from the traffic guy from the news to had a magician years ago to to congressmen, to judges. We had an Ask the Judges panel last year, and it's just a great bar association that we're really focused on trying to give back to the North Fulton area.
Well, some congressmen are also magicians. That's another show. Whatever. Yeah. So tell our listeners, what's the best way to reach back in touch and get in, find out about your work?
Yeah, best way to get in touch with me, you can reach me at mrosenkopf@taylorenglish.com. You can reach me on LinkedIn or through our taylorenglish.com website. Happy to help you out. If you're an attorney and you are interested in joining the North Fulton Bar Association, you can go to northfultonbar.org. And even if you're not an attorney and you need legal representation in the North Fulton area, you can also go to northfultonbar.org.
Nice.
Awesome.
Yeah, sounds good. And so we have another guest coming up here on the show. And of course, all your information will be on Emily's website as well, and the Atlanta Legal Experts website. So thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have C.W. Wright also joining us in the studio. Good morning, C.R. Did I call you C.W.? I just changed your name. For legal reasons, we can't do that, right? Yeah.
I answer to many things.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah, C.R., thank you.
Me too, yeah. So C.R., so you're a partner in the Atlanta office of Fisher & Phillips?
That's correct.
Okay, and a couple of interesting things I noticed on your bio is that prior to joining the firm, you worked in HR for Lockheed Corporation?
Yes.
And but also what's very interesting to me in terms of relevant to your current capacity is you're a police officer for 7 years with Cobb County.
That's correct. I basically couldn't decide what I was going to be when I grew up. So plumbing school's next.
Right. Nice. Let's just take 10 minutes and tell us your
life
best stories of police work. There's got to be some interest. We'll have another show on just for that. But also you are the editor in chief of the Georgia State Law Review.
That's right. While at law school at Georgia State, I was pleased to be able to have the opportunity to serve on Law Review and learn all those very picky points and how you cite cases and whether a period is italicized or not.
Oh, wow. So, according to the Atlanta Magazine, you're also have been selected as a super lawyer, which I thought is really cool. Do you get the cape or is that not included? Or
I'm still waiting on that, so we'll see, but very pleased again to have that recognition.
Yeah, that's a great title. That's congratulations and kudos on that. So, but now back to business. Your specialties in labor and employment law, OSHA, non-compete and trade secrets.
That's correct. We practice labor and employment law, representing businesses, employers, not representing individuals who are coming to sue their company necessarily. Although sometimes we get into situations like that in the non-compete area,
and employee termination. That's pretty touchy. That's you could spend.
Well, I was just listening to Matt talk about the call centers. I have a lot of debt collector and call center clients, and of course, what we deal with is when the employee steps out of line, maybe not complying with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and we get to advise on the termination issues. So, yeah, I do spend a lot of my time day to day advising employers on how to go about taking the proper steps to for employee discipline or termination without running afoul of the numerous laws regulating the employment relationship.
Yeah, as an employer, you can't really stay on top of all that stuff. So you really need good counsel and to really advise you in advance, because if you try to fix it afterwards, you're talking serious money and headaches. And
Let's hope they need me. I need to work.
All right. We can.
We do spend a lot of time being proactive with our clients, setting up policies, handbooks, making sure that do a lot of manager and supervisor training, because you're right. It is hard to keep up with all of the rules, and they're fast changing.
Yeah, they're trying to make their widgets or whatever, right, and make a profit. So talk to us about biometrics in the workplace, and give us maybe you have a couple examples to cite on that.
Yeah, biometrics. Biometrics basically means life measurement, and biometrics have been around for a long time. Whether it, in the old days, just the fact that you had a photo ID and you could be recognized by another person as you had access to the building or whatever. Well, with technology the way it is now, there are a lot of new opportunities for employers to use various forms of biometrics to track, monitor, provide security, provide access for employees. And so I had a number of clients who came to me interested in various biometric methods to track employee time because, of course, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, the federal law that regulates overtime, minimum wage, those type of things, it's the employer's responsibility to have an accurate record of hours worked by non-exempt employees who are entitled to be paid at least minimum wage and receive overtime premium based on the hours they work. So with handwritten time cards and even with manual punch machines, there have been over the years a lot of inaccuracies and a lot of opportunity for people to hold the employer at bay, claiming to have worked more hours than they actually worked. So I have had clients look at fingerprints, hand scanners, and various other types of biometric devices to use in place of the old-fashioned timekeeping systems and be more secure about knowing when the employee was there or not. I also had a client call me. They had installed fingerprint access for the door locks on a new facility.
Right.
And nice. They had a few employees react negatively to handing over their fingerprints, thinking that it could be used in some improper way,
right.
Which if you know much about the modeling and the way the devices work, that's actually not the case. But so the question here was, you know, what does the employer do when an employee refuses to give their fingerprints and therefore cannot have access to the building? Now, interesting, rarely do I hear of somebody refusing to give their fingerprint in order to gain access to the amusement park or the tanning right. bed or whatever else they're wanting to go into. But employees seem to have this natural inclination to react negatively to anything that's asked of them by the employer.
Well, it's kind of a big brother kind of thing, and then you know, it could potentially be used. I mean, is that something, when they activate that, is that stored on some type of system where then they could track their you know, criminal history or whatever? Or
actually, no. It is stored.
Right.
But, and now I'm not an expert in the technology. I was an engineer years ago at Lockheed and other places. Right. But the technology that I've come across and done some reading on, what actually happens is the biometrics, whether it's a fingerprint or a hand scan or right. vein recognition, it can be an iris right. or a right. retina scan, is converted into a mathematical model, binary. Bunch of zeros and ones.
Ah.
And so unlike when I went to the police department and actually had my physical fingerprints
right.
taken, this is, you put your fingerprint on the scanner and it converts it to a model for comparison.
Okay.
And it can adapt over time because while your fingerprints won't change, maybe you're in an environment where there's oil and grease
right.
and other things. But it's depending on the level of technology you're using, and I'll leave that to the people who sell their biometric
right,
devices,
right.
It can very accurately, even more accurately, track. Now, then you have to have the worry of hacking and mimicking. And you know, I heard that it took a matter of hours for somebody to hack into the new phone fingerprint password.
Wow.
Access.
Wow. I was thinking about that because I can open up my phone with my finger.
I do the same thing. These things amaze me.
I know. It's so crazy.
So talked about the legal impact of that, right? From an employer and employee standpoint, what are some potential challenges there?
Well, we already referenced the fact that employees are going to push back and not want to give over their eye scan, or, and it's amazing, the various biometrics. They can even track people and measure them by body odor, shape of ear.
Nice. Rut row.
Gait.
Is that why I wore so much perfume today?
Typing keystrokes. I mean, it's just amazing all the different things.
Yeah. That
it's all
so
about patterns, right?
It's all about patterns and what we uniquely do as individuals.
Huh.
But so the situation I mentioned, which I've had actually happen a few times, where the employee comes and says, well, I'm not going to give you my fingerprints.
Yeah.
It's a matter of education. First of all, the employer has to communicate and let the individual know, hey, look, we can't give your fingerprints over to the FBI
right.
Or law enforcement. That's not the way this works. It's a model, binary, and hopefully break up some of the myths and then explain, well, you know, you've got two choices. If you want to continue to work here, right, you give us your fingerprints or whatever we're asking for, and if you don't, goodbye.
They can really say that?
They can really say that in most states where it's employment at law at will. Employment at will is basically the capitalistic concept that mm-hmm. the employer is providing the job, and both the employer and the employee have the right to terminate the employment relationship at any time for any reason. Yeah. So there are a few states, Illinois among them, Texas, that have started to pass laws regulating how employers must maintain and protect biometric data. You know, just like Matt was talking about, we've got all these consumer protection acts. We have employee protection laws and regulations, too. So many states are getting into the game to provide for the security of this. But in most every case that I've looked at, and with the new technology, there continue to be challenges. It is legal to tell an employee that if you want to continue to work here, you must provide us the biometric data that you need to access. Now, there, you mentioned legal. There's been some other legal challenges on various bases. Going back to years prior, when we didn't have the level of technology we have now, people would use various protections to try to prevent their employer or the government from getting their photograph or their fingerprints. I'm talking about fingerprints on a card.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And some of them used a religious challenge, the mark of the beast, to say that you know, that you're putting this mark on me.
Right. Yeah.
And so those cases generally were not successful. But there has actually been a recent case where the EEOC, which is the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that enforces the employment laws, Title VII, Disabilities Act, et cetera, has brought a case against a company that implemented biometric technology, and they had an employee who refused to provide the biometric data. They terminated that individual, even though his objection was based on a religious belief. He used the mark of the beast theory. Mm. Interestingly, that company, and the case is still ongoing, so we don't have any decision or ruling yet, but the company had made an accommodation for two individuals who were missing fingers as a result.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as well.
So the EEOC's position seems to be they made an accommodation for the disability but not an accommodation for the religious belief. And so it's going to be interesting to watch that case and see how it turns out.
That's really interesting. You kind of addressed the security aspect of it. Can you tell me a little more about the security aspect of using biometrics?
Absolutely. The security, depending again on the level of technology you're using, is much higher using the biometric data. Now let's take the example of timekeeping. I have some clients who have a policy where you use your badge to swipe in.
Yeah.
And if an employee knows that they're running late, they have learned that what they do is they hide their badge and they go to human resources and they say, I forgot my badge today. Mm. And that way they don't get a tardy. They get excused because they forgot their badge and it's a different issue. Well, it's hard to say, oh, I forgot to bring my hand with me to work today.
Right. It's my pocket. I can't find it. Yeah.
And so, you know, in terms of accountability and the use of the biometric data, it's much improved. Also, companies are using it for access to computer systems, access to physical areas of the workplace, mm-hmm. and with the more secure technology that the hackers haven't gotten to yet, it is thought to be a much more secure than, for instance, a key
or password, whatever. Yeah,
password.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. They keep
that's
making really us change our password every month.
I know it's, and I can't think of any more. I'm like, I don't know. Tell me a little about. Give us a few tips any employer should consider before implementing the use of biometrics in the workplace.
Well, you've got to consider the privacy and some of the other areas we've mentioned, for instance, protected class challenges, be alert to any pushback. But if you're going to roll out a new system, like biometrics, for whatever purpose in the workplace, first you need to communicate with employees about it. You need to help educate them, give them advance notification, let them know what's coming. Given how rapidly the law is developing in this area, you're also going to need to update your understanding of the privacy laws and the various, like that case I mentioned that the EEOC is bringing. You know, you're going to want to follow that and see how things play out. Next, you're going to have to make sure you maintain the security of the data you collect such that it is protected from unauthorized access.
You can protect that security with your own bio-identical. Oh, I'm sorry.
Perhaps so. Perhaps so. We'll leave that to the IT people.
Use your fingerprint.
And you have to decide, you know, what are we going to do with this data when an employee leaves the company? Yeah. Are we going to destroy it, or are we going to keep it on file? Of course, if a company has a collective bargaining agent, a union that they have to deal with, it's certainly something that you may have to negotiate the terms and conditions of employment.
Mm-hmm.
And as you implement the biometric technology, be flexible. Be responsive to individuals who push back, listen to what their concerns are, and try to persuade or do whatever you can to get over the objections and keep things running smoothly.
We need to use those for conference room hours, and people just scan their
don't
eyes.
Don't get any so ideas, whatever, yeah.
Sorry. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us, CR?
Well, just generally, employers are finding a lot of success.
Sure.
City of New York, although they had a lot of pushback, including their union, they implemented biometrics for timekeeping and found it to be a huge success. So it's something that businesses really ought to consider, and the business and governments, too, are already using it for other purposes.
Yeah, of course.
It's just when it comes to using it for employees, it's a little different world. Exactly. So do consider it and be careful moving forward.
Thank you so much for being on today. If you'll tell our listeners how they can reach you.
Sure. My email address is cwright@laborlawyers.com, all one word with an S, Labor Lawyers. You can also go on our website at laborlawyers.com, and feel free to contact me if I can be of assistance in any way.
And we'll get your fingerprint as you leave the studio. We'll post that on the website. Yeah, we'll put his fingerprint on the website. Yeah.
Well, like when I'm at Publix or Kroger, and you know, you swipe your card, and then they ask you 20 more questions. I'm just like, okay, do you want my blood type now? Do you want? Oh.
Nobody asked me any questions. I remember Radio Shack. They used to ask me for my phone number when I was buying, you know, like a headphone or whatever. I'm like,
okay, we've got saved the best for last, I'll say. Right. We have Loretta Lepore here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. She is the founder of strategic communications firm Lepore Associates, LLC, and is a principal in Media Bar Services, a media coaching and presentation training consultancy. Her career spans more than two decades as a journalist and network news anchor.
Gubernatorial.
Gubernatorial.
Goober, yes.
That just took me for a loop.
Our honorary
there.
Goober or whatever.
Gubernatorial spokeswoman.
There you go. Spokeswoman and consultant to corporate, entrepreneurial, and nonprofit clients. She has managed diverse client portfolio with interests ranging from healthcare to technology to transportation. Loretta has leveraged her expertise in public strategy, crisis and issues management, as well as message development, media relations, interview coaching, and presentation training to help her clients achieve their business goals. During her tenure with the national law firm McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, she designed and executed communications and crisis management strategies on behalf of lawyers, lobbyists, and their clients. She was appointed by Governor Sonny Perdue. Loretta led Georgia's effort to re-energize its brand, and she managed the subsequent launch of the nationally acclaimed Georgia logo, website, and global commerce and tourism advertising campaigns. While serving as the governor's press secretary, she was the administration's primary spokesperson and the chief communications liaison with the White House planning team for the G8 summit, which drew thousands of global journalists to Sea Island. A former journalist herself, Loretta worked for CNN, NPR, Westwood Radio Networks, as well as local stations in Washington, D.C., and Florida. We got a lot of Florida people
connections
here.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we can't afford to hire on Radio X, but maybe one day or whatever, yeah.
You're aspiring.
Yeah,
to
exactly,
that.
Yeah.
I'm so glad to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Welcome.
Thank you. Tell me, what was the impetus for launching Media Bar?
Well, there were a couple of things. I think, as Matthew pointed out, we're seeing a lot more litigation in our society. So there are a lot more attorneys out there, and there are a lot, and there's a lot more media attention on the cases that are being tried. We find that in the media, they're constantly searching for experts, and those attorneys are not coached. That's not a skill that they learn in law school. It's not a skill they learn while working in a firm. So they've been coming to us and with more regularity. So we formalized our process and launched Media Bar about 2 years ago.
That's really interesting. That's a niche for
and,
sure.
And back up for a second, because I'm a little bit familiar. I've been to the website, but Media Bar, people that haven't heard about it, what's your pitch, I guess, description of it?
So Media Bar essentially is a customized service where we work with attorneys and other professionals. So it's not just specific to the legal profession, but essentially we help them if they have a desire or a need or they find themselves before the media. So we provide media coaching, what to expect, as well as presentation training. So oftentimes attorneys are presenting in various capacities, whether it's a business development presentation, whether it's, you know, in a courtroom setting, or and as a speaker. Oftentimes lawyers are asked to speak before large audiences on a specific topic. They become thought leaders in a specific area, as both of your guests here today have very specific niches that they've become experts in. And so we help them with all the tools they need to be more effective speakers.
When did you launch Media Bar? What year?
2012.
Oh, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Tell me, who seeks your counsel? Who else? You talked about lawyers, so tell me some other examples of some other people.
So we see right now, for example, a lot of attention on the healthcare profession, in particular administrators within a hospital setting due to all the new regulatory issues that are coming down the pike.
Sure.
So there's a lot of questions from the media about how will they transition, how will they stay in business, how will they comport or comply with the new regulations. So that's one area of particular endpoint. We work with a lot of just C-level executives that perhaps find themselves in the C-suite and now having to deal with media, whereas before they may have not been in that kind of capacity. And we work with a number of political candidates who find themselves in the media all the time.
Right. Now tell me, why should someone consider actually engaging with the media if they're not thrown in front of the media? Tell me, what would benefit
them? Can they just opt out or whatever? Is that not an option, I guess?
Or opt
well, well, I mean, I'll give you an example. Oftentimes, attorneys, depending on how they practice, don't really have an option. And sometimes they have to speak to the media on behalf of their clients. If they're representing a client, they can find themselves in a situation as part of their representation. And that may be on the record or that may be just on background. But it behooves an attorney to know how to deal with the media if they have not had that experience and how to even be able to, you know, figure out what the reporter is looking for, how to navigate that conversation with a reporter, but more importantly, to find out the information in advance of the interview so that they're prepared going into it. I think oftentimes, for example, I had a client who was a criminal defense attorney and he was not seeking out media attention, but he had some very high-profile cases back-to-back, and he'd walk out of the courtroom, and there'd be a gaggle of reporters standing outside the room just waiting for him. And while he had was very, you know, adept at explaining the nuances of the case, he always felt like he was a deer in headlights. And so it was in his client's best interest that he addressed the questions that the media had, but he didn't feel as though he was able to do it on his terms and that he was always being caught. So we worked towards some ways that he could be better prepared in dealing for that. And I think when, and you guys, your other guests can certainly speak to that, but I don't think there are many times when you're representing a client that you can say, no, I don't want to do that. I mean, I think as you're building...
I will not speak on your behalf. Hello?
It's another thing if you're building a practice, and a lot of lawyers I learned, particularly in large firms, part of their responsibility is building out their own practice, so they're entrepreneurs in their own right.
Sure.
And, you know, the media is one way to do that. It may not be a TV or radio interview. It may be something more subtle, or it might be a print interview. And that's something they can opt in or opt out of. I know that there are some attorneys that are also very conscientious about, and for lack of a better word, but not seeming like they're an ambulance chaser. So there's also that fine line between deciding where you want to be, how often you want to be out there, and then picking those right places to be to communicate whatever it is that you're trying to get across and finding the right audiences for your message.
So there's a lot to it.
There's a lot more than people think.
Yeah.
And oftentimes people find themselves getting in trouble when they don't think in advance about a lot of these things. And that's where they get hung up.
Well, we've seen a lot of celebrities where they you can tell. Well, it's also, it seems more kind of like after the fact you realize, boy, that was unfortunate. The course that they chose, you know, to address a hot issue on their brand. They went there just on YouTube or the not just social media, but in front of different types of press outlets. And then, you know, it's over. You know, you can't fix that.
It's a publicist's nightmare, you know, when people just walk out there and say whatever. Also, you know, the other downside, too, for a lot of high profile individuals is, and I always think of the case of Tiger Woods, you know, when he encountered all of his media attention, it was over a Thanksgiving weekend, and he said nothing for like 4 days, but it was Thanksgiving weekend. So the media had 4 days to just go hog wild and have absolutely no one representing his interests. And you know, it didn't necessarily have to be him, but there certainly needed to be someone to represent those interests so that, you know, it just got carried away. It was a snowball effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the flip side of it. You think like, well, you know, I'll just let it blow over or whatever, right? And if I just keep quiet, but then people start adding their own context to it and their own
Their own commentary.
Things can come out wrong. I mean, you know, you could be thinking one thing and saying a different thing, and it's all of a sudden
sounds
not
like you need a consultant.
Well, getting on the show this quickly, I should have, you know, consulted with Loretta beforehand.
Right. And I think sometimes too, one of the things I've learned recently, I was speaking to a group of trial lawyers last week, and one of the attorneys said, you know, I have a very high profile case coming down the pike, and should I be reaching out to the media about this in advance of the case to lay some groundwork? Well, the idea of preparing, knowing that it was going to be an issue that was going to be in the media was a good one. The idea of him doing it himself was not a good one. And the reason being is that anytime you can have an intermediary to kind of filter that information and get all of the information up front before you have to go out and speak to it is a good thing.
When you kind of create a natural buffer. And then worst case scenario, if things don't go quite right, then you can always, you know, step in later maybe and correct the messenger, right?
Exactly.
Now tell me, what are the ingredients that make, we were talking about how there's a lot to it, that makes someone a credible media source?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think one, you know, I always speak to the issue of authenticity. So what are you genuinely concerned about? Where does your passion lie? Because if you focus on what's most important to you or what your passion is, you will come across as a better expert in that area.
Sure.
The other way that you become very credible, obviously, is having a specific area of expertise, knowing what that expertise is and staying within that defined scope of your expertise. So sometimes what will occur is, you know, a person, it could be a lawyer, it could be anybody, will go on and go into an interview situation, and their expertise might be employment law, but then they get thrown a random question about, you know, whatever,
family
defense
law.
Litigation, you know, and that's not their area of expertise. And the natural inclination of an individual is to try to answer that question. And so you have to be very purposeful in going into the setting and knowing, no, this is what I can talk about. And when those questions do come up, to be able to say, that's really not my area of expertise. And, you know, if it's not a live interview, you can refer somebody else and say, but I know Joe Smith in my practice that can answer all those questions for you. Or, you know, if it is a live interview, it's perfectly fine to say, you know, that's just not my area of expertise.
Sure.
But really being defined in knowing what your expertise is and sticking to it, and then being able to back up, why are you an expert in this field? And I think both of your, as you did the introductions for both of your guests here for today, we learned that they were notable lawyers in their specific fields and were recognized for that. So that makes them credible in that space.
Okay.
Yeah, because is it still like the cardinal rule to say no comment? Is that kind of like a, what's your take on that?
I'd love to say I'm not taking questions.
Yes, I always advise folks never to say no comment because it always appears as though you're hiding something.
Yeah, that's the perception, right?
Right, exactly, or wrong.
I like what you're saying is that that's not my field of expertise, or often you hear him say there's pending litigation on that, so I can't comment on it.
Right.
But also you could just legitimately say, I don't have an answer for that. Let me research that, do some due diligence, and
get back to you on that.
Or the third joiner,
right. And the third option is always, I'm not at liberty to discuss that at this point.
Yeah.
But when I am, I will let you know.
I have seen that a lot. Yeah. I've heard that a lot too. Yeah. Go ahead.
You talked about media, obviously in radio, but you got all forms print. To all different types of video as well. So are there certain industries or clients that are just more natural? I mean, how do you select, okay, you have this client A, is it based on their industry or the topic? Is there an ideal? I mean, how do you determine this is the media outlet that's appropriate?
Right. So, today, because your audience is really focused on the legal profession, there are specific shows, for example, that are dedicated to legal issues, as this one is. And we see more of a proliferation, as I said, in that area. That's one way. Another way is to, for example, I had an attorney who is a lawyer, and I asked him, what do you do? And he was explaining to me that he's a trial lawyer and he focuses on civil litigation, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, well, tell me some of the cases that you're working on. Well, he has a big NFL case. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, ESPN is a great outlet for you too. It's not we don't have court TV anymore, but it's not just that outlet. Think about where else might be applicable to some of the casework that you're doing as well.
Sure.
You think about what a person's general comfort level is. Some people don't ever want to be in front of a camera ever.
Right,
so
yeah.
They
That's
shouldn't
why we like
be
radio.
There. Yeah. Some people may have a very thick accent. They may not be native to this country, but they may be a phenomenal expert. They may be well-schooled in their particular discipline. And so maybe print is the better option for them. Mm-hmm. So we look at the individual, again, looking at their strengths and figure out with them where they want to be.
A lot of times you see just high-profile people, whether they're celebrities or athletes or politicians. But a lot of times it seems like they'll go on a late-night show, whatever, mm-hmm. And it kind of, I'd be interested in your take on that, but it kind of tones down the noise or whatever, right? And kind of makes them more real, in that casual setting. You think that'd be the last outlet they'd want to go in front of CNN or something, right? But, what's your...
Well, I think that oftentimes the reason you see candidates doing that is because it humanizes them.
Yeah.
It takes them out of their predictable element, provides a little bit of the unpredictable, and hits their demographics or their audiences in a different way when they're more comfortable too.
Right.
So, I think you do see that a lot in the political area.
And they're not likely to get those tough ambush questions or whatever, yeah. So
right, it's much more
comfortable.
And it's a much more controlled environment
than
a news environment.
So this this phrase, what you say isn't as important as how you say it. What's your take on that?
I think both are equally important. I think what you say is critical. And I think the mistake that some people make is that they don't think about what they're going to say before they get in front of the microphone or before they pick up the phone to call the reporter. And it really doesn't matter what the circumstances, you need to think about what you're going to say. And then how you say it is equally important. So if you think about the fact, this program affords a great opportunity for some depth and length to talk about the issues that are important to your guests. But oftentimes in the media, you have 30 seconds to communicate an entire message.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have to be very concise. And so how you say that is very important too, and your demeanor, how you come across, is very important.
There's a lot more languages than just
English,
vocal, right? Yeah. Your body language,
your eyes,
and the inflection. I don't know how people remember Zig Ziglar, the motivational speaker, mm-hmm. whatever. But he used to use that phrase. He'd use that sentence to say, "It does depend on how you say it." In this context, he'd say, "I did not say she stole the money," right? Or it's, "I did not say she stole the money." Right?
So exactly.
Or I did not say she stole the money.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's, well, it's and all, the other.
Right? It's the same sentence.
It is. And oftentimes people may have one speaking voice and they'll get in front of a microphone and their pitch goes up about, and they're real, real high talking. And that indicates a nervousness.
Right.
It dents your credibility. And so you have to think about all of those things.
Well,
too.
What always kills me is you see I haven't seen it in a while, but you see these analysts afterwards that they analyze after the interview's done and they say, so read their body language. And you have this third party out there in somewhere land and they're watching the video and they're saying, because this person did this, mm-hmm. it's likely they're not telling the truth. And I'm like, wow, you don't have a chance to counter that, you know? So
exactly.
I was going to ask you, how do you get most of your clients? Is it through referrals or?
We've been very fortunate thus far. We've had a lot of word of mouth and so referral basis. And also just, you know, being out in the community and speaking with folks.
Being on Atlanta Legal Experts.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That was a given.
We'll edit that in. We always put the sound bites in that this person said, and then it's in a different voice or a different accent. But I do have a last follow-up question. I don't know if we have time for a little roundtable or comments from the guests as well. But can you give some idea as far as structure if somebody were to seek out your services? Are there classes or seminars or workshops or kind of one-on-one? Or, I mean, what's the kind of the mechanics behind the scenes of...
For media services, yeah. We do one-on-one training. Because it's a customizable service, we will adapt to whatever environment a client would like us to. So we do a lot of one-on-one training. Typically in a one-on-one training, we're working with them 3 to 4 hours for 2 days. First day, come in, get them acclimated, work through a bunch of issues, help them with their individual brand, figure out where they, you know, help with all those things that I've talked about where they want to be, what their expertise is, establishing their credibility. And the second day we'll come in and we'll actually do mock interviews and create a tape that were then used if they decide that's something they want to go out and do. They do want to, you know, work with a publicist and be actively engaged with the media in some way or do PR, need PR assistance in some way. We will create a videotape for them to use. And, you know, everything's going video these days. So mm-hmm. that's the greatest tool. It doesn't matter whether you're working in the media or you just have a Facebook page,
it's everywhere.
Video gets you everywhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then certainly we go in and speak with large groups. So as I said, I spoke to a group of the Atlanta Trial Lawyers Association and went in and spoke with that group. It was about 50 individuals. We do have CLE approval. So the attorneys can get some of their credit.
Oh, cool.
By going through the program.
Nice.
Cool.
Yeah, so I have just a couple minutes if anybody wants to ask any of the other guests questions or...
It's your turn to play host or co-host, whatever, yeah.
If not, that's fine.
Well, I'd kind of just follow up for CR. So this whole idea, we were talking about the biometrics and it's all about fingerprints and everything else, but it's really kind of contingent on... the type of business that they're in, you know, wouldn't the court say, you know, because not everybody could are just arbitrarily require that. Wouldn't there be some contingencies on the type of transactions that are taking place? If it's a security issue, that's the only reason to kind of have that, or is it all based on employee records? But because it's kind of like drug testing, right? You can't just drug test everybody necessarily. But if they're driving a vehicle or if it's going to, you know, they're in a situation where it's going to impact their performance, yes or yes?
Well, it depends.
See, which is the standard, good coaching, whatever. Yeah, that's good. That's a good one, right?
Standard legal answer. And by the way, you know, it just goes against an attorney's grain to say they don't know something about anything. So, but you're right, Rich. It, depending on what the employer is trying to accomplish and what the environment is, maybe it's a salesperson who's on the road and rarely in the office.
Right.
Maybe it's a machine shop environment. So the court's not really going to put restrictions on what an employer wants to do in these areas as long as it's pursuing a rational, legitimate business need.
See, that's my point, rational. So, I mean, I'm trying to think of an example, but where it's, you know, at Starbucks or whatever, right? I mean... They don't really need that type of security for making coffee. Right?
Well, but Starbucks has had a number of lawsuits employees who alleged that their timekeeping was not accurate.
Okay. Mm.
So Starbucks would have an
timekeeping
excellent, excellent reason to want to use some form of biometric data to tell when an employee was or was not there. You know, it's called buddy punching. A lot of times, you get there early and you see that your buddy's running late,
right.
So you
help him out.
Stamp him or her, you stamp the time card or whatever. And so employers have had enough of being taken advantage mm-hmm. of by people who want to look at the records and challenge them. And so even Starbucks would have a reason to want to use, for instance, the timekeeping system with a more verifiable authentication of who the individuals are that are there working.
Right. But yeah, and I guess that kind of makes sense. But then also, and on their global scale, I mean, they've got to do that kind of to cover themselves. But
it's
on
a good account.
The employee standpoint, is it kind of can protect them too? Because now you don't have to worry about your supervisor kind of fudging the records or whatever, you know. So it keeps them both honest potentially, right?
Well, I've certainly seen allegations that the supervisor went into the system, but there's an audit trail for all that.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the beautiful thing about it. Right. So, yeah, that's the other part of the communication that the employer needs to cover, is to help employees understand that there's nothing that's being given over that's going to be used for other purposes. It's going to be secure, and it also protects the employee in many respects.
Loretta, I apologize. I've missed the let our listeners
oh, yeah.
know.
That's probably my fault, yeah.
Yeah, that was your fault. Slacking on the job. We need your fingerprint. Would you let our listeners know how they could reach you?
Sure. Our website is mediabarservices.com, and my email is loretta@mediabarservices.com. And my phone number is 404-402-2647, and reach me any way that's easiest.
And I've actually thought of a couple people already that I could probably introduce you to.
That would be fabulous.
Wonderful. Yeah, absolutely.
A great show.
Yeah.
Right. I concur. Jeez. Yeah. Ryan, what are your thoughts?
Wonderful job. Right? Great guest. Fun time in the studio today. So thank you all very much.